2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 262, My Creed, Writing One's Personal Articles of Faith. A panel featuring John Hatch, Michael Nielsen, Julie Curtis, Matthew Workman, and Lisa Tinsmeyer Hansen.
To My Creed, Writing One's Personal Articles of Faith. I am John Hatch. I am the Sunstone Symposium Coordinator, the Sunstone Managing Editor. The other panelists with us are Michael Nielsen, Julie Curtis, and Matt Workman. Lisa Hansen is listed on the program, but I do not believe she notified us last minute that she cannot come. And I apologize for that, for anyone who had come to see her and not be bored by me. I mentioned me. Let me get to the others, and I thank both Julie and Michael, who just rushed from other sessions where they had been speaking. We work people hard here at Sunstone, so thanks to them. Michael Nielsen is a Sunstone columnist, and if you've ever read his column, it's wonderful. I love it, and I look forward to. I get to typeset all the columns and read them, and so I always enjoy doing that. He is married to Sheila. They are the parents of a 15-year-old daughter and a 3-month-old son. He has published 36 articles and papers dealing with psychology and religion, and he teaches psychology of religion, social psychology, and other courses at Georgia Southern University. Julie Curtis is a general manager of a marketing strategy firm. Do you work for Worthlin? Okay, you don't work for Worthlin anymore. I'm sorry. Julie has a master's of public policy from Harvard. And was an English major at Brigham Young University, loves writing and literature, and is married to Matt Workman, who I do not have a bio for, which is my fault, so I'll just tell you a quick story. I'll tell you a quick story about Matt. Matt lifted me up in a moment of my despair without knowing it when I was working on the final program at like 1 in the morning. I opened my email that had Matt's bio line for our program. Now, if you look through our program, there's some pretty impressive things in there. For example, Harvard, Yale, people who are professors, doctoral students, all sorts of things that are far more impressive than me. And I get to Matt's bio line, and he says GED Fairport High School, which and. you might be surprised to also learn that Matt is a comedian and a performer in Los Angeles and an aspiring journalist. Well, I'm going to begin, and then we'll turn the time over to far more interesting people. A couple of caveats before I mention my creeds. I'm a relatively young person. I'm 26 years old. And so many of the issues that I deal with in faith, many of you probably went through a long time ago. So please bear with me if I talk about issues that seem a bit juvenile to you or go, come on, we dealt with that years ago. Second, I should warn you, I changed this after the past 2 days of Sunstone. And, well, the creeds are the same, but I added some different information. I'm going to be referring to so-called liberals and conservatives, and I just want everyone to note that I do not do that intending to paint people with a broad brush or anything like that. And I do not mean, if I just use those terms, I do not mean to imply that anyone who identifies themselves with either of those labels is guilty of some of the things I might talk about. And lastly, in changing this, I'm going to be frank and blunt, and I recognize that I run the risk of being a little bit politically incorrect, as some at Sunstone might see it. But I'm going to say what I want anyway, because that's what Sunstone is supposed to be all about. If I'm out of line as an employee of Sunstone, Julie and also Mike can tell on me. They're on our board of directors. But let me get on to my creeds. Number one, I am most at peace when questions need not be answered. That's not to say that they don't have answers, but that I don't need to answer them. And that also isn't to say that I believe in pushing things to the back of my mind or just ignoring them. In fact, I am troubled by some church members who simply dismiss any issue or difficulty by claiming that it will all be sorted out in the next life. However, after much reading and prayer and studying on certain issues, I realize that many questions are indeed unanswerable. and trying to make answers fit leaves me unsatisfied and unfulfilled. Going the way of the apologist leaves doubts lingering in the back of my mind, and I suspect going the way of the ex-Mormon who believes Mormonism is a fraud would leave me feeling dishonest. I've just seen far too much good and spirituality in Mormonism to claim that it is nothing more than an invention of Joseph Smith. For an example, I've given up trying to make things like polygamy fit. Did Joseph practice it because God told him to? Well, if so, God's a sexist and kind of a jerk, and I don't believe that God is either a sexist or a jerk. Did Joseph practice polygamy because he was a pervert? If so, then that puts a damper on that whole prophet thing, and I don't believe Joseph was just a pervert. I have a theory, and it is just a theory, but I believe that the line between sexual energy and charisma is thin and blurred. We see this with people like Bill Clinton, John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., and even men such as Benjamin Franklin. I believe that Joseph Smith enjoyed women and enjoyed the company of women, both casual and sexual. And early in his life, he may have seen himself as a sinner, troubled by his temptations and desires. But as time progressed and as he looked at the Bible and translated the Bible, he may have seen ancient prophets and read about polygamy and concubines. And perhaps his troubled thoughts of sin disappeared, and he perhaps even saw more divine evidence of his prophetic calling, because wouldn't it be natural that he would be drawn to women just as ancient prophets were if they were polygamous? It's just a theory, and I'm perfectly at peace saying that it's just a theory. At the end of the day, I don't need to make it fit. I don't need to be right or wrong or have an explanation as to why Joseph Smith did what he did in that regard and in other regards. Some people seem to want me to believe that Mormonism is the only way, and I believe this is simply impossible. No matter how many times we claim to be right or claim spiritual experiences, it will never diminish the spiritual experiences found in other faith traditions. I reject the common notion, Mormon notions, that people in other faiths have spiritual manifestations either A, because Satan has deceived them, or B, God feels sorry for them and throws them a bone every once in a while to get them on the right track to get to our church. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that each argument could be turned around and used on us. I'm also troubled by circular arguments we use to claim to be the one true church. For example, the true church of God has to have the priesthood. Well, hey, we have the priesthood. We must be the true church of God. It strikes me as a tad bit convenient that we set the rules, then when we're the only ones who play by those rules, declare ourselves the winners. I reject this, and I believe there is much spirituality in other faith traditions. However, I also know how I have felt in Mormonism. You may call it the spirit, you may call it inspiration, you may call it whatever you want, but I have no intention or interest in rationalizing or diminishing those experiences. I have felt what I believe to be God in Mormonism. I believe he is here just as I believe he is elsewhere. My second and final creed, I only have two, I'm sorry, is being right is never right. I have seen nothing but pain and division when one group of people claims to have all the right answers and then expects others to fall in line. We all claim that our ideas are the correct ones, but my question and the most important principle to me is how do we treat others when they don't agree with us? For example, it is entirely one thing when the church claims to be the true church and then sends out missionaries to spread that message. I have absolutely no objection to that. But it is quite another when church members are excluded from ward or church activities because they are not seen as being orthodox enough. So some of you might be thinking, since we are here at Sunstone, and perhaps you're not, yes, those idiot exclusionary church members. However, I am also, and frankly mainly, referring to some of the people involved in Sunstone. After attending the Wednesday and Thursday plenary sessions with Martin Luther King III and the September 6th, I became concerned that Sunstone may be perceived as nothing more than a mirror of the church, a liberal mirror of the church. Let me explain by first saying that I have absolutely no objections to what the speaker said, and I have to digress and say that a meeting with Martin Luther King III was one of the highlights of my life. I'm 26 years old, and I've already done things that I recognize many people will never have an opportunity to do in a lifetime, and I never forget how blessed I am. As we sat in a room talking with him, he was talking about his childhood as casually as you or I would talk about it, saying, you know, oh, my mom wouldn't let me do this, or my dad made me do that. And I just thought, yeah, but who are your parents? I mean, think about that. We all say that, and it was a remarkable experience. But I have to confess that I'm a little bit troubled by the lack of balance at these two evening events. And I think the symposium coordinator really dropped the ball on this one. Not really, but I wish we could have come up with something that offered a little bit more balance, even at later sessions. I'm not troubled again by what they said, but perhaps by the reaction of the audience, and not because I think they should have reacted differently, but again because it seems to be a liberal mirror of the church. Let me offer three examples as to what I mean. When I tell the average church member that I voted, particularly here in Utah, when I voted for Bill Clinton by absentee ballot on my mission, no less, jaws drop and tension fills the air. The look on people's faces is unmistakable. It is one of, you should know better than that. And I suppose they think I should know better because I'm a member of the church. Well, I am an equal opportunity offender, and when I tell the average Sunstoner that I voted for George W. Bush, I get the exact same look. One of shock and the look of, you should know better, you're a part of Sunstone. Again, I go to that mirror image. We act exactly the same without meaning to. And I suppose I go back to saying that being right is never right, regardless of what side you're on. And I just hate disunity. I hate people who feel that other people have to be, well, I don't hate people, but I hate the idea that other people have to be like them. Breaking off to that political argument a little bit is I don't feel any kind of kinship with conservatives because they seem to have often what I see as a holier-than-thou attitude. The worst thing Bill Clinton could have ever done is had sex or not had sex with Monica Lewinsky, according to him. But unfortunately, many of the liberals who I call friends seem to have a smarter-than-thou attitude. The worst thing George W. Bush could do is have a C-grade point average, and both are mocked because of their supposed sins. A second example, I am deeply disturbed and troubled when one group assumes dubious motives on the part of another. When church members or church leaders assume people like me or groups like Sunstone or Dialogue are trying to be destructive or just a pain, I feel hurt. When Boyd K. Packer accused Michael Quinn of writing his brilliant article on post-manifesto polygamy to, quote, embarrass the church, end quote, I was very upset. Likewise, however, I am troubled and hurt when liberals accuse church leaders or the church of dubious motives, of only wanting obedience, of trying to control and manipulate, of only desiring power. I believe almost everyone has good intentions and good motives and is just trying to do their best. Some are guilty of the same actions of those that they point their fingers at. Again, are we just a mirror of those we often talk about? And my final example deals with the audience reactions at those two events that I mentioned earlier about the plenaries. And this is my other theory of how the church works. I've observed in gospel doctrine classes and priesthood lessons that the most conservative view wins out usually, and it's usually the conservative view of a minority. At least this seems to be the case in the Utah church. This minority control what is said. I'll give you an example. Someone raises their hand in a gospel doctrine class and says that polygamy is an eternal principle and we'll all practice it in the next life. Now, I know my ward members, and I know from hallway conversations and that sort of thing that as much as 70% of the class doesn't believe that. But no one raises their hand. No one says, you're crazy. I mean, I do, but most wards people don't. No one offers objections. And I think, what if a visitor were in this class? Would they believe that the whole class feels this way because no one raised their hands? What happens is the most conservative view wins out, even though most people don't believe it. And I wonder if at Sunstone the most liberal view wins out, even though some or even most people don't believe it. As Martin Luther King III and Paul Toscano criticized President Bush, scattered applause began and others joined in, but as I watched very carefully, no more at any time did half of the audience join in with this applause. Again, I wonder if a visitor was there. And I know that there was not I wonder if there had been a visitor, would the message have been clear that this is only a liberal group not interested really in an open forum and hearing different viewpoints? Now, I recognize that there wasn't much of an opportunity to stand up and say how they felt, but I truly wonder how someone would have been treated if they would have stood up and said, well, I support President Bush, or I support the war in Iraq, or something along those lines. Perhaps they would have been well received, perhaps not. But I say that being right is never right when you are so convinced that your actions are correct and the way you think is correct, that you expect others to go along, that you think they just need to see the light, whether it's religious light from conservatives or intellectual light from liberals. I hope that we at Sunstone and anybody out there is not just a mirror of somebody else that we don't want to be like. And I hope that we can all learn to appreciate others and their beliefs and give them respect. And I stumble because I just can't even express that the ideas are not important to me. What Mr. King said is not important to me. But the idea that people get along is important to me. I don't know why, I just can't handle it, but I just hate the thought of people not getting along and thinking that other people have to be like them. Thank you.
I've only attended one of these My Creed sessions before, so if I'm doing it wrong, just nod, smile, that would be good. My understanding is I'm supposed to say a few things about what I believe, kind of the core of my belief or faith, however you might want to say it. Being a social psychologist, then I have to start with the power of the situation. The situations that we find ourselves in have a tremendous impact on what it is we do and how we think and how we act. Our situations lead us to act in certain ways appropriate to the situation. There are lots of examples. I don't know how many of you took Intro to Psych or one of those kinds of classes, but there's the famous study that Solomon Asch did with conformity, where he showed people a target line and then asked them which of these three lines matches. And they did this in a group. What the real subject of the experiment was about, though, was conformity. And everyone in the group was in on the experiment except for the next to last person. So they go around the room and they start out, just to make it more believable, saying the right answer. So line one is matching, line two is matching, and so on. But then partway through, they start giving the wrong answer, just to see what that one person who's really the subject of the experiment will do. And even though it's very clear that a particular line is the right answer, most people said whatever it was the group said. And that's a sort of simple example, but it wasn't so simple to the people. The people involved really got into it. They were worked up over it, and they tried hard to figure out how it is that everybody else could see this other line being right, when to them it looked like that was the wrong answer. Another study, maybe a bit more famous, Milgram's study on obedience, where he had people believe they were shocking someone else. And for all that they knew, the person that they were shocking was dead. I mean, they shocked them so much, they started at 15 volts and went up in 15 volt increments until it got up to 400 or so volts. And they heard protests from the next room where this other person supposedly was, saying, "Let me out, I've got a heart condition, it's bothering me, let me out, let me out." And two-thirds of the people kept on pushing the button. Why? Because that's what they were supposed to do. That was their job in the situation. Now, it's easy for us to think, "Oh, I would never do that." And yet, when I look at my own life, I have the sad but true Popsicle Man incident. I was in a new neighborhood, just about to go to third grade, wanted to be accepted by my peers. And to my shock and surprise and wonder, not only were other fellow third graders trying to make friends with me, but there were some fifth graders that did. To a third grader, that's a big deal. And they said, "You know, Mike, this would be really great if what you would do is, when the Popsicle Man comes around," some poor college student trying to make some money in the summer, "when he comes around, we're going to go on one side and buy a popsicle, fudge sickle. And what we want you to do is spit on him. But you'll be on your bike, and so you'll be able to ride right away. You'll get away. It'll be great fun. Me being the impressionable third grader, yeah, okay, sure. And I do it. And I start pedaling away, and I hear his footsteps boom, 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 boom behind me. And he was in good shape. I can feel, at one point, I felt his handlebar, his fingers grab around the sissy bar of my bike. It was back when bikes had sissy bars, if you know when that was. And so I lurched on the pedals a little bit harder, and he let go and tumbled down to the ground, and I thought that was close. But I didn't realize that the real close call was about to come when the neighbors, looking out to see what the commotion was, let my folks know. Why did I do such a stupid thing? The situation. People want to be wanted. So when the situation says, do this, do this. So in my creed, I believe that we have to choose our situations as carefully as we can. Sometimes we do make the right choice. We don't spit on the popsicle man. We make the better choice. And we do that even despite the pressures that are around us. So what do I learn from this? I learn charity. When I see someone else spit on the popsicle man or whatever else it is that they've done, I need to remember the importance of the situation in dictating what it was they might have done. And I also recognize that I've been very fortunate in terms of time and place. My accident of birth was really a lucky one. I don't know if it was an accident, if it was divine destiny. I don't know that. I sometimes frankly wonder if I'll ever know that. But I do know that it's my responsibility, having been born when and where I was, that I need to work hard in whatever way I can to improve the lot of the lives of people who weren't born into that kind of situation, but instead were born into conflict and strife. My second creed or article of faith or what have you is that people can be very good and inspirational. Many of the things I like about Mormonism are its heresies that separate it from traditional Christianity. And one of those, maybe for me the most important one, is that children are born innocent and pure and beautiful without sin and have a tremendous potential to do good. I really believe that. And for me, it probably is an article of faith, because you can make a pretty good argument against it. But I'm not going to be the one to make that argument. I'd rather believe in the goodness. Of course, I recognize that the same kinds of forces that nature and nurture and choice that gave us Gandhi also gave us Stalin and Pol Pot. For the vast majority of us, we find ourselves in the middle between those two extremes. We fall short, way short, of Gandhi's goodness, and we also fall far above Stalin's ability to terrorize most of the world. We do have the hope of improvement and the choices that bring us change, and change to the people around us, changes that also have an effect on the other people's situations. Because I do believe that the situation is very powerful. If we change ours a little bit, we're also changing someone else's, so we need to try to change them for the better. A third part of my creed is love and compassion. I think that a lot of the change that comes that's really worthwhile does so but because of love and compassion. Being a person and thinking that at some level there's a basic sort of selfishness in all of us, I recognize many times when I've been the recipient of love and compassion, generous gestures like that, whether it's from the child who, 3 months old, see, I can't even say this without crying. My little boy, in the morning time, you hear him in the bassinet, turn him over, and he beams with a smile. Can a three-month-old know love? I don't know. But I'm very convinced that I know love better because of him. And as adults, we can be compassionate and loving toward one another for different reasons. Well, for adopting a three-month-old most recently, we were the beneficiaries of tremendous generosity, not only from the birth mother. And I can't begin to describe how that generosity makes me feel, but even from simple friends. The friends who said to us not so long ago, you know, we're getting a new car, and we know yours is falling apart, which it was, 86 Pontiacs only go so far. They say, would you be offended if we gave you our old Escort? Love and compassion really can change and make things better. It changes our situations, makes it easier for others if we make those few right choices. So that's my... Okay, I lost track. Third. A fourth article of faith, you might say, or part of my creed, is that I'm very convinced I don't know everything I should know. I don't know all that there is. I'm convinced that there's something bigger than I that I don't understand. I'm not sure what to call it. I'd be very honest... I need to be very honest and say I have a lot of doubts, and that's actually something I wanted to talk about for a second, but... One thing that buoys me through those periods of doubt is a dream I had. I was never a big dreamer, not a visionary kind of guy. But a few years ago, I was preparing to go to a conference in Ukraine. And my most foreign experience was either going to Niagara Falls or to Kentucky, depending on how you look at it. So before that time, I was living a very sheltered life, really. I don't speak, I can speak about five words of Russian or Ukrainian. But I was nervous. Never done something like that all by my lonesome. About maybe 10 days before my trip, I had this dream. And it was, every now and then I remember dreams. I don't know if you do. But they're usually something like falling out of a helicopter and landing into a dinosaur's mouth. I don't know. Things like that. This dream was different. I dreamt that I was in Ukraine, that I walked up a long flight of stairs, went into an apartment, and was greeted by someone. They sat me down in a chair and then sat right up close to me. I dreamt about this man's face. His glasses, now typical Soviet kind of glasses, think of those. His thin lips with a broad smile. And about 2 weeks later, I met that man. The thing is, with things like that, I can say that, and it means a lot to me. I've heard other people give similar kinds of stories, and my nature nurture mind, my scientific training says, okay, yeah, it's this and it's that and probably some of this third thing, and that's why it happened. But when those things happen to you, it's meaningful. And that experience for me buoys me through some really severe periods of doubt. Like I say, I don't know what it is, but there is something greater than I, that I don't understand. And the last component of my creed is the idea of change and humility. Change is central to how I see my own beliefs. My spiritual path is filled with changes. A lot of the things that I knew, a lot of the statements of fact that I had, they're not questions. They've changed, they've morphed, they're very different now than they once were. And at first I resisted this with a lot of effort. I wanted something firm and immobile. I didn't want shifting, changing, sands, winds, things like that. But then I realized that, at least for me, that this is the way it is. And I can see this in different ways. Even in science, which sometimes we tend to think about as hard fact and cold and things like that, science requires the person who does the experiment to be open to the possibility that it's not going to turn out the way you think it is. You have to be open to alternative theories, alternative explanations. There's a sort of humility that it requires that is very important. The same is true in our spiritual growth. If we don't have that humility and openness to change, at least from my perspective, we're probably not going to be growing very much. That's required in order for me, at least, to grow and learn. So, situations, choices, basic human goodness, love and compassion, uncertainty, change and humility, this is my creed.
In doing a little background reading to help me with my own creed, as I had not been to a My Creed session before and didn't know quite how to prepare, I turned to where else? The internet for help. I found the well-known Nicene Creed and the Apostles' Creed. Those are two long-standing and fairly well-known assertions of Christian faith. In a simple Google search on the internet, if you type in like creed and belief, some combination of terms like that, you may be interested to find, as I did, you can find statements of creed on several Muslim sites. There's a firefighter's creed, a samurai creed, a Church of Scientology creed, and there's even, I'm not kidding, a Jedi creed. And I have copies of those. I printed them out and read for them, to read over them in case anyone's interested. So check with me afterward on the Jedi creed. As I started working on my own creed, it was kind of like working on a ninth grade mathematics proof. I don't know if they still teach simple proofs in ninth grade, or that's probably sixth grade these days or something, but where you kind of establish something as a fact and then kind of build on that. And I felt that I needed to do that to sort of say, okay, what's the foundation, and then what can I build on from that foundation, from the more straightforward to the more, I know that complex is the right word, but the more elaborate or something. So I wrote a creed. This is more in the spirit of the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed, a statement of faith that is a few lines long, and then I'll go back and comment on a few tenets of that creed, my creed. I believe that God is. I believe that Christ is my Savior, and that God encompasses both father and mother. God is the God of all things and all truth-seeking religions, a God of love. God created all living things with spirits, endowing them with the divine. God knows me and every other creature intimately and wants each of us to have joy. Through the Holy Spirit, God speaks to me, and his hand is active in my life. I believe that I am accountable first and foremost to my God, and that you are accountable to your God. At the same time, we are both accountable for the well-being of our fellows. Zion is what we build together. Spiritual gifts and temporal blessings are meant to enrich the lives of those around us. I believe in a Christian karma that combines justice with grace and faith to repay us for our deeds, for good or ill. God will sort things out in the end. Love, which comes from God, is a redemptive, healing, transformative, and divine force for good. The point of everything is love. Love and everything else in my life I owe to God. So that's my statement of creed, and it may not be particularly linear in its form, but For me, it's one thing kind of leading to the next. The first couple of statements, I believe that God is, and I believe that Christ is my Savior, are kind of simple statements establishing that I believe in God and that I'm a Christian. I believe that God is mother and father is about the wholeness and the completeness that is part of my conception of the divine. I believe that God is the God of all things and all religions. Another way of stating this might be that God isn't Mormon. At least I don't believe that God's Mormon. And that kind of helps me stay in the church sometimes. I believe that God is a God of love. I believe that God is fundamentally motivated by a supreme love for each of his creations. And that God also has a divine love for both life that is mortal and life that is eternal, and that the point of this life for us, from God's perspective, is to help us bridge that gap between the mortal life and the eternal life and enjoy the love that is part of both of those. I believe that God created all living things with spirits, endowing them with the divine. To me, this is about seeing the divine, seeing a little bit of divinity in everything around us and everyone around us. Each creature has a little bit of godliness, and it's possible, I believe, this is kind of a caveat or an appendix to this tenet, that it's possible to read and sense and commune with these spirits, that all living things are in some sense holy, and that we can sense them or commune with them in the way that we commune with God. I believe that God knows me and every other creature intimately and wants us to have joy. To me, that's what the ripe strawberry is to the pill bug. That's what the sun-drenched rock is to the lizard in the desert. It's what a healthy krill bed is to the whale. And for me, while God knows what brings me joy, and often, fortunately, he provides that to me as to each creature in the natural world, I believe that God speaks to me through the Holy Spirit and that his hand is active in my life. God plays an active role in the lives of his children. At least I believe that. It isn't always evident. In fact, it appears sometimes that God has forsaken some of his children. I don't understand why. I don't understand why life is terrible for some people and wonderful for others. But I do know that God's hand is in my life, and that part of my responsibility for this blessing is to try and spread the goodness of that hand to those for whom it might not come so easily or so evidently. The tenet, I believe that I'm accountable first and foremost to my God, and you are accountable to your God. A few years ago, when I was troubled by actually the September 6th excommunications and other issues that were going on in the LDS church at the time, my father gave some very wise words to me. He said, "Julie, one of the great things about our theology in the Mormon church is that we don't believe that the church has the right to deprive you of salvation, that you're judged by God. And so the church can take away your membership, but the church can't take away your salvation. And ultimately that is between those people and God." And that became then a tenet of my belief and understanding that I need to do what's right by God. And in a way, it's also a tenet that helps me believe that there will be justice in the end, that everyone has the ultimate accountability of their actions for God. And that somehow also helps me get through and make sense of a difficult and sometimes horrible world. I believe that we're all in this together. This idea that people are accountable not only for themselves, but also for each other and each other's well-being. This juxtaposes interestingly with the idea that each person is accountable for themselves to God. On the surface, it seems like there might be a contradiction, this individual accountability, but at the same time, an accountability for the well-being of those around us, the communal. It's a Christian challenge. It's the pilgrim's progress to find the place where these things fit together. But it's also the perfect paradox of Christianity, of how we live a life that's honest by ourselves and our God and others. I believe that Zion is what we build together. To me, Zion isn't something that will ever appear out of the sky. Maybe it will, and I'll be surprised. Instead, I do believe that it's up to us. It depends on us to bring that about and build it. In Christ's prayer, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done," is not an appeal, but it's an intent, it's a promise, it's a covenant that Christ was making and that he asks each of us to make in building Zion. I believe that spiritual gifts and temporal blessings are meant to enrich the lives of those around us. This is about how the more you give, the more you receive. It's the law of infinite exponential returns that I believe is part of the gospel. And it's related to that Christian karma that I mentioned. What you do comes back to you. What you reap is what you sow. And this also is tempered with the possibility of redemption in Christian faith and repentance. So this is also a belief that helps me find meaning in a pain-filled world sometimes. I believe that God will sort things out in the end. I trust that God knows what he's doing and will rectify injustices when all it is said and done and reward those who deserve rewards. And that ultimately he loves everyone and we will all find our ideal outcome. I believe that love is redemptive, healing, and transformative and divine, a force for good. Through some divine physics, I believe that love and priesthood and power are all inevitably and infinitely intertwined. And this is the power of the gospel and the power of life. And I owe all of these things to God, including this creed and my understanding of it. So thank you.
I'm a little embarrassed. I have never been to a creed session before and had not even had a chance to read the program. Julie just asked, would you be a part of this? She said, it's my creed, and it shouldn't be longer than 5 minutes because you'll be the last person getting up and everybody talks for a long time. And you'll need to make sure that we get out on time. And so I said, fine. And she said it was my creed, and I think most reasonable people, when hearing the title of this session, I believe most of you have walked into this session with the assumption that today we were going to talk about the rock band Creed and their music and what they're about. And I was very anxious to speak on that subject, as I have a lot to say about them. Did the rest of you come to hear about Creed? Yes. Just so for a little background, Creed was formed in Fort Lauderdale in 1995. Their first album they put out by themselves, a major label picked it up and it was certified platinum. This led to their 1998 release, Human Clay. It debuted at number one on the Billboard charts and is perhaps the most wretched and mediocre album ever put out by a major band ever. This led to their certified diamond platinum follow-up called Weathered in 2001. It is my personal belief that Creed is the worst multi-platinum band ever. And I don't say that lightly. I have heard the Spice Girls album. I don't just throw this term around. But Creed, in my opinion, is the worst multi-plat. Upon hearing what other people were saying and reading the program, I'm to understand that the tone was to be a little bit different. Webster's Downloadable Dictionary defines Creed as a formal statement of religious belief, a confession of faith. Or, the second definition is, a system of belief, principles, or opinions, laws banning discrimination on the basis of race or creed, an architectural creed that demanded simple lines. That is definition number two. So, in that respect, I would say that I believe in a God who's funny, but not like back-slapping, wacky guy in the office funny. More of an eyebrow-raised Garrison Keillor kind of funny, like, you know, who slips the jokes by you, and a day later you go, oh, yeah, that's pretty good. I use as my reference on this, and you'll forgive me, please, I don't have the scriptures with me, but some of you may know this reference because they actually use this story in Sunday school. It was one of the Sunday schools where I wasn't hanging out in the foyer talking to people, but I went in, and they were talking about the talking donkey story. Is anybody here familiar with the talking donkey story? Yes. I believe it's in Numbers, and correct me if I'm wrong. I don't have the exact reference, but if you need it, give me your email address. I'll send it to you. I promise this is in the scriptures, where a king, has done some bad things, and he's on his way out of town. He's riding on his donkey. An angel of God appears on the road in which they're to go, and the donkey will not move further. The man on the donkey is beating it, saying, no, we need to go. We need to get out of town. And the scriptures say that the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey. And the donkey says to his owner, why are you beating me? Don't you know that I'm a good servant of yours and would not just stop unless there was good reason? And that of itself is kind of an amusing story, but much more amusing when I was on my mission and people had problems with the idea of maybe there being a horse in America before the Spaniards arrived, but who proclaimed to believe everything in the Bible flat out. So you can't buy a horse 600 BC, but talking donkey, I'm on board for that. So, you know, so they've surely had a lot of faith, but maybe application's a little wavering. And my only second tenet, I have never claimed to be as brilliant as people that actually write down articles of faith. I'm not a fraction as brilliant as Julie. That's why we even out, like balance in all things. The equal and opposite reaction to the previous talk you heard. Or maybe the equivalent in this form of at the end of the newscast, you know, here. And finally tonight, that's kind of been the story of my life. I'm the "and finally tonight" guy. but my second premise, your premise, article, creed, faith thing, is that I believe that when we die, we will be judged for our actions, and God will ask us only two questions. The first is, how did you treat my children? And I don't know what the second one is. Thank you.
We do have 10 minutes for questions. If you have questions for any panelists, I'll repeat it and they can come up. If you do not, then we could have Matt come up and tell more jokes. I don't. Any questions at all? We're going to get out early. Yes, Madison. You came up with things in a Sunday school class to add to the articles of faith based on revelations from modern prophets, and would we... Well, I don't know if I... That's a good question. Would I add to my articles of faith, or would I add to the church's articles of faith? I guess I should clarify. Right. I don't have anything to add. I'm going to ask Michael to come up and Julie and Matt.
Well, part of my creed has changed, so I would expect some additions and some deletions, and and probably an occasional bonk on the head to wake me up to the reality that I'm unaware of at the moment. So,
When I was preparing for the Creed, I actually did read through the Articles of Faith again. That is the primary model for the session. And after I put together my own articles, I went back through the Articles of Faith to see, what there was that I might have left out. And I wouldn't pretend to, suggest that that Joseph Smith left anything out. And in a lot of ways, the Articles of Faith are a nice compilation of the essence of our belief. Joseph does include the article, "We believe that men will be judged for their own sins and not for Adam's transgression." But I might put in something along the lines of the Golden Rule about doing to others as you would have them do unto you, or this idea of accountability for each other and love. And not that I feel it's necessarily an omission, but simply a stronger faith, or a stronger statement of the Christian faith and that highest rule that Christ asked us to pursue.
I am so poor a theologian that I would not dare mess with anything, add nor subtract, because I'm already, God's letting me still hang out just because I believe he's interested in, maybe I'll pull off something interesting. But if I start messing with Articles of Faith, he might just pull the plug. So I would decline to answer any further.
I also echo what Julie said about the Golden Rule, I suppose. And also, this is good because this makes me thinking about refocusing on the Articles of Faith. I didn't, so I'm going to reread them. Any other questions? Yes. I'll be brief and then ask everyone else to come up. My first creed about I am most at peace when I don't need to make everything fit. I mean, my period in Mormonism has been like this roller coaster. Went on a mission without having really read the Book of Mormon. I mean, my story is like so typical and just it's a gross cliche. It went in there. I remember, and a few of my friends have talked about this, but I read LeGrand Richards' book, A Marvelous Work and a Wonder, and read like the scriptures about the prophecies in Isaiah about the Book of Mormon, and I'm like, do people know about this? I mean, we got to tell people about this. I was just so psyched reading this stuff, and this was in the MTC. I got, on my mission, I got really, I fell in love with, Farms, a very apologetic group, in particular, Review of Books, and really enjoyed that sort of thing and got involved in apologetics. I read more anti-Mormon literature on my mission than I'm sure most people, could possibly imagine, and loved responding to it. But, I kind of reached a point, I guess, where, like I said, there's a point where there's always things you can only go so far with that. I think you can be a very good apologist in a very positive way, but you also have to confess certain things. And I think some of those apologists that I were reading, at least from Farms, weren't willing to do that. They weren't willing to say, Brigham got it wrong with this. I mean, I think that's an okay apologist way to say it, is that Brigham Young was a great man, but he got such and such wrong. And so I kind of went from that to becoming a part of Sunstone. And I suspect that maybe you have to pick almost as you study the history of the church in great detail. You have a handful of choices. You can leave, you can ignore it, you can become an apologist, or you can sort of go the way of Sunstone. There may be others. But that was me for my first one. And my second one is just something that,
much like church members get to do, they get to see the church at its best and its worst. As an employee of Sunstone, I get to see Sunstone at its best and its worst, and most of the time it's at its best. But it just, I was very reflective on that and thinking, you know, what is the, we're always asking at Sunstone. Don't think we have a real straight idea. We ask, what's the role of Sunstone in the church? We don't believe we should be telling the church what to do. So what truly is the role? And that's just something I was reflecting on, and certainly hope with my comments I didn't offend or make it sound like that I have a problem with Sunstone, because I don't. But just reflecting on that and what are we doing? What is the point? Yeah.
When I gave my comments, I told the story about my father sharing with me the idea about who we're most accountable for, and so there was that personal experience. Also, my this idea of the spirit of that all living things have spirits. When I first read through sections of the Pearl of Great Price, I loved the scripture about the earth. The spirit of the earth, and you know, unfortunately, the spirit of the earth, I think, is groaning in that section of scripture. But this beautiful idea that the earth itself has a spirit, and I was quite taken with that, saying, "Well, if the earth has a spirit, what else has spirits?" And that God created everything spiritually before He created it temporally. And between that and spending a lot of time hiking or backpacking or doing things in the wilderness and kind of communing with the natural world, just ended up strengthening my belief in you know, that aspect of my tenets. And other things, as I was reading over things, I don't know that another particular personal experience jumps out. Other than just simply, you know, living each day trying to do what you think is important and what you think is right and, you know, the what would Jesus do stuff, that actually does beg a lot of very significant questions about what we should be spending our lives doing. And I don't pretend to be doing it all that well. But I guess the other part of it, though, is when my father was teaching me that I'm ultimately accountable to God, that was sort of freeing in that. It sort of opened this door, this idea that, well, I can also work out my own theology with God, and it is generally a Mormon theology as well. But people have accused me of not being the most orthodox person around. But that's okay. I don't think I want to be the most orthodox person around. But the just the ongoing conversation with the divine and what makes me tick and what seems to make sense and kind of, I guess, speak peace to my heart.
Believe it or not, I actually do have a story that involves the like 2.5 seconds of actual seriousness in my thing. I'd said that, you know, I believe that, you know, the big question that God will ask us is, how did we treat the people around us, our brothers and sisters, His children? And I developed that idea during a period of time. It was a difficult period of time for me. It was, I've lived in California for 7 years, so I was around during the Prop 22 campaign, which was a difficult time for me and a lot of my friends struggling with the church signing on to a political campaign that many of us, that many of my friends and I thought was a misdirected, that the resources of the church were being misdirected, that the great, the financial and organizational and spiritual power of the church was being pointed in a direction that was not maybe the best direction it could go, and that and I struggled for a long time as many of my friends were being called into bishop's office and being asked to donate money for Prop 22 and things like that, and I never was, I think, for two reasons. One, because, you know, the bishop was seeing my tithing records and knew I had no money. And two, I was out of town a lot because I was dating Julie at the time, who lived up here, so maybe they thought I wasn't active. So, best not to rock the boat. But I'd struggled for a long time about how I was going to deal with what would happen if I got that call and if I got called into the bishop's office and asked, will you give money for this? Because my conscience would not permit me to do that. And so, and it was then that I realized that that God would not be judging us on, have you put down the gays? Have you, have you Bible bashed with this guy? Did you really let people know how wrong they were? And that we would not be asked that question. And that though, and that in the long run, that meant nothing. But what we were responsible for was, how did you treat your brothers and sisters? What did you do for them? How did you make them feel? Did you show them love? And that everything else was a periphery to that. And that if you could focus on that, and I'm not saying that I'm necessarily all that good at holding myself up as a shining example of that, but that if you could make that your central focus, that when you died, it would be all right.
I believe we are out of time. Thanks for coming and listening to our beliefs. We appreciate it. Thanks.